After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nichtern. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit eherenownetwork.com/David.
David Kahn.
Hello.
Welcome to the CSM podcast. It's so great to be able to talk to you. We talk at length for sometimes, right? We get into all kinds of topics of conversation.
Yes.
So this is going to center around, I guess, the themes in the podcast are coming from the book that I have out called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, all of which you've had a taste of in your life, I would think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Had a taste of all those.
Which do you think is the strongest thread?
The strongest thread?
Of those three.
Was it? It was creativity.
Spirituality.
Spirituality.
Making a buck.
Making a buck. For me?
Yeah.
Creativity.
Yeah.
Because it leads to the other two.
How would you define creativity?
Hey, I've got an idea.
Ah, that's it. That was the definition.
Well, that's my definition of heaven and hell. Heaven is, hey, I've got an idea. And hell is, hey, you're in my way.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot simpler than some other descriptions that I've heard, even some other descriptions that I've given. But while you're on the topic of heaven, the book really starts off with that principle of joining heaven and earth.
Uh-huh.
So you know that paradigm because you've studied Chinese medicine and so forth and in your time.
Yes.
So heaven, just we mean the sort of unobstructed quality of possibilities and the expanse of the mind and the vastness of the sky and the universe, and at a human level, just that anything's possible. And then earth, of course, is, I think it's the guy who's in my way is, I'm not sure I'd call it hell, but it might be more like earth for sure. Some kind of obstacles, reckonings, things to synchronize, to coordinate, to overcome, to integrate, to work around sometimes. So the principle of joining heaven and earth is that you have some kind of great idea and you actually can manifest it and connect heaven and earth. That's yes. Supposed to be the role of leaders and leadership and all kinds of things, artists and so forth. Does that resonate with you?
Yes.
What is your heaven? What's your idea of a kind of expansive and, you know, unobstructed situation? What would that be for you?
Well, one of them is when I would come to an agreement with an artist that I'm working with, as opposed to my own idea, my own concept. It happens to me on my own, like when I work on my ballet music or I'm working on a piece of music and I figure something out and it actually sounds better. That's a resonant moment. That's
resonant
the word.
Moment.
That's
the word. So when you're in sync with the with what you were trying to create?
Or? Yeah. And in music, you're actually creating resonance. So an example, it happened to me at the ocean thing I did with National Geographic in the fifth room. It was all sound effects, and I kept changing and changing and changing, moving stuff around, and pitch and length, and but it was all noises. And they decided they wanted music. And when I went, okay, so I went in and we set up the music. I started working on music in the room, and things gradually sounded better as I moved, and I realized I'd done the sound effects in the key of D.
Literally?
Yeah. Well, because when I would work, I realized in the key of D, and that there was some resonance going on, like my ear had found some sort of pitch center with all the sounds that I was working with. And so when I worked in the key of D, which is the room is in, I put a little bit in and the music would work better than if I was in E flat or.
So heaven is resonance.
Yes.
And kind of harmony, balance.
And some, the total is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
That's what happens in the resonance.
Is this sort of a transcendent kind of feeling?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like tuning, you know, the well-tempered tuning. And when you hear it, when it's actually the slight non-linear tuning that's actually the most in tune, there is a something that happens that's keeps moving and just that, I guess, resonance is the word I use for it.
Right.
But I love it because it's a great term for music.
So, Dave, one of the kind of interesting things about you to me is that you've had a florid and flourishing career making fabulous hit pop records, which is a certain zone. But you also, and people might not know this about you as much, I'm trying to think of the right word for it. Intellectual actually comes to mind, but also, you're into projects that are quite advanced technically, that are advanced in terms of what the crossover between sound and music is. You know, you're working on some cool projects right now about that. So you have a pretty broad spectrum of creative expression. Would you say that's true?
Yes, but I think it all comes from the same place because the technology is resonant in and of itself. When there's a new instrument, you see new possibilities, or there's a new way to edit, or that's one reason I've kept up with technology, because it would be like when they put valves on the French horn,
that's
they were
technology.
Able to play in any key.
Mm-hmm.
That's tech,
mm-hmm.
or the 808 drum machine.
But if you're working on a project like producing a Regina Spektor album, and then you go towards, you know, designing a holographic whale, installation, is that the same Dave or a ballet, writing music for a ballet or writing some of the books that you're writing? Is that all you? Is that different parts of you? Is that all just the same you?
No, it feels the same.
Uh-huh.
It's just figuring out the technology of that particular situation.
Uh-huh.
Like the technology of Regina's voice is different than the technology of Ingrid Michaelson's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Two beautiful singers.
Right.
But to figure out how to record it and also how to arrange around it is, there's things that Regina sounds beautiful on that Ingrid would sound a little dull.
Yeah. And did you ever study arranging formally?
No, just, I got very formal about reading scores of Stravinsky and Prokofiev and Bartok.
But how did you even learn how to do that?
I don't know. I just...
You never went to school for music?
I studied it some in college. I took a four-part writing class that was pretty life-changing to me. Although it was a train ride where I took the book with me and realized what it was.
But you didn't major in music, did you?
No, I majored in English.
Yeah, me too.
Here we are.
That's people who don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
And I taught English for 4 years.
But you went from that to reading Stravinsky scores? I mean, I don't, there must have been some kind of music tulku thing there, if that's true.
Well, I studied the theory, so I was interested in the actual technology of scale building, for instance. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in studying that, what intervals were, and I was looking at notes, and I couldn't really play onto an instrument, but it was just learning a different language. And then in the scoring, it was fascinating because, I realized looking at a Bartok page and a Bartok score that he was actually mixing, because he's got a crescendo, decrescendo marking on the French horns, which is a fader move.
Uh-huh.
And he's had the violas and violins go to harmonics, which is adding 5K and a digital saturator. So he's telling everybody not only what note to play and at what time to play it, mm-hmm. but also how they should play it. And it's arranging and mixing all on a page. And it's sort of hit me.
Wow. So really what I'm hearing you say is that it's kind of all the same in a way. The same principles are operating through everything that you do.
Yes.
Yeah. You're not really thinking, oh, now I'm over here doing pop music and now I'm over here doing Bartok or something like that. It just has the same energetic to it.
Yes. It's the same notes. But
that sounds like,
if I record a drummer, right. I'm going to have a different situation as far as the arrangement goes with the kick drum than if I recorded it on an old MPC with a sample set in it. So the kick drum, the bottom would be different. And how do you make that work?
So in terms of your life and, manifesting what you hope to and want to manifest, do you feel like you're in heaven right now in terms of your work? Like, are you doing exactly what you want to be doing? Is there something you'd rather be doing, something you're not doing that you wish you could be doing? Are you just right in sync with your vision?
No, that's an excursion. I'm in between most of the time. Like, I guess maybe I'm assuming everyone is. I go up sometimes when something comes together, and when I can't figure something out or somebody screws me over, I'm out of it.
Uh-huh.
And I worked on a track for a singer a few months ago, and it was as perfect as I could imagine, and it was beautiful for her voice, and it was going to be her first single. And then I found out her guitar player talked her into taking it off the record and using his version. Uh-huh. And he made her paranoid that it was too pop.
Uh-huh. Was she a pop singer?
She was on that song, and she sounded amazing. Uh-huh. And she's never had a big single. And she's not even – it's her own label.
Uh-huh.
And it was a miracle to find this one song and fix it. And she loved it for a while, and then he kind of worked his way on her. So I was down. It was a lost opportunity for her,
right.
And I was – upset because it was a lost opportunity for me to help and
to realize the vision of what I set out to do.
And the record came out and didn't have a single, and it's sitting there not doing much. I'm not saying that would have saved it, but it was the shot.
So, one of the threads, you've read the book, so you know this, but one of the threads is that you have sense of vision, and then you sort of have an offering that you want to put out there. And then there's a sort of fork in the road between the offering is just what it is. It's just, that's what I heard. It's content driven,
Yes.
And then the other thing is, well, actually, this is going out into a marketplace, and I want to accelerate its activity in the marketplace, which is market driven. And you're operating in both arenas.
Yes, I'm operating in both arenas. That's why I took the jobs at the record companies. So
what jobs were those, Dave, for people who don't
know? I did A&R. So I was A&R and then head of A&R at Columbia Records, and then I was head of A&R at Warner's. And I loved bringing – when I would have an artist like Jeff Buckley, who I brought into Columbia when they weren't working his record, it was doing well in France. And that was like saying this record is over for some reason in the music business.
Yeah.
Well, we're doing good in France. but I was able to go to some people and say, why don't we try this? And I went to my boss, and he explained why they were saying one thing to him but doing and not doing. And then he inspired them to work on it in the UK, and I guess inspired is the word. Threatened is another.
Okay.
And they worked it. Or I had another artist had a beautiful single that ended up being a number one urban hit, and they weren't working it. And I hired a remixer to do a remix of the record whose father might have happened to have been a radio promoter. And he worked it, and it was number, it went to number, they played it on the mix show on Z100, and it blew up.
Now, you just shifted modalities.
Yes.
Seamlessly. I kind of want to point that out to our listeners out there, because that's what we're talking about. All of a sudden, we were talking to a kind of pure composer. It didn't sound like there'd be any consequence at all, whether it sold one thing or a million things. That's, I'm looking for the resonance. I'm looking for the fulfillment of the vision that I have. And you just switched personalities. You sounded like a kind of seasoned, hardcore business operative. Did you feel that shift?
No.
So it felt like still that's the same Dave?
It's the same person.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think maybe an analogy would be I'm in a bar in South Sacramento playing a blues song, and everybody's staring at me. They look like wallpaper. And then I play a Beatles song, and they go, oh, and they like it, and they're listening. So I've marketed myself mm-hmm. to that situation with the proper content. That really is how I see it. I don't want to do, actually, I'd love to do a goth version of Bartok string quartet. But that would be something where you would be deciding what is the possibility here.
Yeah.
And I think you're always marketing yourself. If I have a song and I take it to an A&R person, mm-hmm. I go, what do you think of this? And they go, no. You know, I want to make sure I'm taking them the right song and that it's in the right form.
So how important, you know, there's another kind of reference to the relationship between success and contentment. How important is success to you, would you say? Or how would you define it? Let's start there.
Success to me would be where what you've created and you feel good about gets across. And I guess that's the business side or the marketing side. If I'm working with, there's been a lot of projects I've worked on that haven't gotten across that should have. I feel like they were really great, and they were never got any traction or resonance in the community.
So that felt unsuccessful. Like,
yes, it felt successful as a piece of music,
right?
To such a degree that when it didn't work in the marketplace,
right.
For whatever reason, a lot of times it's mishandled by the people that are working it. And not being at a record company, I don't have much control over that.
Right.
But that the bittersweetness of knowing that you've created something very resonant and touching, and yet it didn't
get
over you've got a success on one side and not on the other.
So would I be right in saying that success for you is actually creating a vision musically or sonically and creating resonance and transcendence or a particular feeling, and then having that be communicated to what, a large group of people, to the right group of people?
It could be large. It could be, I'm thinking of an example, the Strokes album I produced, First Impressions of Earth. There was a song in there called You Only Live Once. And I felt that was a crossover song.
Hold a minute, Dave. This is a Buddhist podcast.
Oh.
Go ahead.
He said it tongue in cheek.
Okay.
So they had it at the label and something was going on and they didn't work it as a single and they actually tested it. In my opinion, it was a song that you would get on three stations that were Strokes fans and build up the bass like we did with Walk Like an Egyptian, and which was not getting the attention. And then a station added it, one station, and it blew up. So they tested it, and it didn't test well because it's not that kind of a song. But when it didn't test well, they didn't work it as a single. And over the years since it came out, I've had so many people come to me and say, I love that song. How come it wasn't
successful?
Blow up. Yeah. Strokes fans.
So there's artistically successful and then there's commercially successful.
Yes.
Right? Those are two adjacent but different things, right?
Yes.
And am I right in sort of thinking that you like both?
Yes.
That's the home run is when you get both. It's creatively successful and it's commercially successful.
Yes. I mean, I've thought about that a lot, whether or not I'm a poorly operating person who should just be able to be so satisfied with something that I've made
right.
and just leave it at that.
Right.
And I do have a few things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I'm on my motorcycle and there's an experience of being on the motorcycle outside in the Tetons,
mm-hmm.
and there'll be a moment of this is right.
Yeah,
I'm fine of myself. So that idea has always fascinated me about sharing.
Uh-huh.
Can I make something without the urge to share? And when I'm writing for a book or for something that I'm just pure writing,
sure.
and I'll come up with an idea. And when I was writing about not sharing, and I had a really great idea about it and how you could do that. And as I wrote it, I had this impulse to share it.
To share the not sharing.
Yes. And that was a big moment. I don't know. Are there people who are so like, they're able to do that in your experience?
Well, the sharing seems to be a profoundly human characteristic. You know, I think we're social beings, and it would be unusual for somebody not to want to share. It would be more unusual. But the dimension of the sharing, so I think if people knew all the different things that you do, like, you and I have shared a lot of the sort of more arcane, if you will, or intellectual or kind of obviously not commercial things that you do. You're writing books and you're doing some sound projects that I don't think you think those are going to be mainstream things, do you? Or do you?
Mainstream, no.
Like millions of people going, oh, I heard
that. Not for the book.
Yeah, I think you have a whole other side to you that I've been exposed to that probably maybe a lot of people wouldn't know from the CB. So, but sharing with somebody, sure, even if it's just one person. So it's an interesting thing. Like, for example, when somebody goes into retreat in meditation,
mm-hmm.
My teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, his teacher was Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And he was in a cave for 15 years by himself. Who are you sharing with?
Well, did he share with himself? Is that the...
Well, I think, I can only imagine.
Is there a mechanism for that is what I'm asking, because I've wondered about that.
Yeah, well, I was in retreat for a month once, and I can tell you this. At a certain point, I went, you still have your internal dialogue.
Yeah.
Even though you start to wonder who's talking to who. There's a real moment. And then I did have this train of thought, like, why am I still chattering? I'm here alone. I already know everything that I know. I'm not telling myself something new. So it's a rehashing that's kind of going on. But it's very rare that that internal dialogue just dies down. I mean, maybe after a year or something like that, it might get really quiet inside there.
Well, I've read in books that studying it that there's this a lot of times a goal for that. It seems
that kind of quiescence, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. And the thing about sharing, like when I was writing about not having to share and wanting to share what I wrote about it, my feeling was I share, like the sharing and not having a reaction is hurts. That's the, my joke for myself is that I'm the worst salesman and I'm preparing for the disappointment because my sales pitch is for a song, I'll show it to an artist and my pitch is, you're probably not going to like this.
So there's a chapter in the book called Never Negotiate Against Yourself.
Yes.
you pre-negotiate against yourself when you say that. Why would you say that to somebody?
Well, it's a thought. I wouldn't necessarily
say it. Oh, you didn't say it.
But I'm I don't know if I would call it negotiating against myself because I could look at it another way, this is probably going to be rejected. And so I'm just getting over it now. But I'm going to show it to him anyway. When I was signed on Capitol, I wrote a song called Rock and Roll is Dead and We Have Killed It. This was in 1977. Rock and Roll is Dead and We Have Killed It. Let's throw it in the grave and walk away. The promises were never kept, but still we hear the echoes yet. Remember, you must fear what you believe. And it was because I was watching all these bands and I was seeing all the hippie stuff that was idealistic and not happening, coming true. And I showed it to the A&R guy. I don't know.
Wait, you were an artist at that point?
Yeah, I was signed on Capitol.
As Dave Kahn or as a band?
Well, it was one of my high school students. I was started writing songs with him. He was very talented. And he looked about 5 years older than I did. So I made my first recordings on a 4-track and shopped it and we got signed.
Wow.
We went down to LA and did a showcase and got signed. So when I turned that record in for the album and I thought, this is on the edge and it's talking about all of these people that were saying all this stuff about how this is all going to change and it's not changing and a lot of people are doing it out of greed and it was complicated. But the A&R guy gave me the 1,000-year stare and he just shook his head and went, no, what do you know? No. And that was the end.
Yeah.
So that experience was...
Well, don't you think creative people have to face a lot of rejection?
Yes.
Part of the gig, right?
Yeah. Self-rejection and...
Yeah.
And when you know it's not right, but you don't know why.
Yeah.
And you keep looking for reasons and then something comes together and you're in this moment of, oh, yes, the strange attractor happens and there's a coalescing of energy.
Yeah, there's another chapter called Polishing a Turd, which I got really from Linda Gottlieb, who was the producer of Dirty Dancing, if you remember that movie.
Yeah.
And she produced the music for One Life to Live when I was doing the score for One Life to Live. And she would just say at a certain point, like, you know, we would keep making edits and additions and layers and key changes. And she would just say, stop polishing a turd.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you think that we all ever get to that point where you just go like, no, this is really, I should just move on from this one?
Yes. At the record companies, I was in charge of the sewage treatment plant. So, yeah, there was... stuff where you'd realize, especially with some artists that had been signed and they'd been working on for a long time, or trying to resurrect certain artists, and there would be nothing there. Right. But they would be taking up huge resources at the same time. And so you're trying to conserve resources and put it towards things that might work. That's always a dialogue that's going on at any business, I assume, at shoe companies. No, we need the croc purse. Right. Whatever somebody's idea was.
So what's interesting is you've...
Can I tell you one funny one?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I had worked for a long time to build a website where people could put music up. And it was for Warner Brothers, but I was doing it in a way that I wanted it to be not corporate. And I had it almost working. I'd hired somebody to do A&R, but she also turned out to be a really good programmer. And we'd put this site together over a period of 4 or 5 months, and they could have street teams for the artists and so on. So I was getting ready to roll it out, and we wanted to keep it on the low. It was cool time. And a new president came in and with a bunch of other people. And I talked about the website. That's a great idea. What's it called? Well, we don't have a name for it. Oh, well, let us think about that. Next day, we've got the name for the site. What's it called? Big Ears. Okay, so I'm dying inside.
I'm dying inside.
And I said, you mean like Bugs Bunny?
Oh, yeah, this is like satire. Yes. Here.
So somebody.
He said yes when you said Bugs Bunny?
Yes. So there was the moment of the tie-in of the logo and the thing with the ears. And I it was darkly humorous, but it was going to ruin the premise of the site. And so I dropped the whole thing. We never put it online.
You couldn't fight for it?
No, that was one of the things that led me to say it's time for me to go.
And go independent?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was independent for 5 years between Warner's and Columbia.
So, and just producing records independently?
Yeah, that's when I did Sugar Ray and Sublime and another Tony Bennett record, a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But I, that kind of stuff happens... happened a lot.
What I was struck by is like, I didn't realize you had been an artist yourself, which is, excuse me, interesting point of departure if you ever wanted to go back to that, if you ever thought of going back to that.
To being an artist?
Yeah.
Well, as a ballet composer, yes.
Yeah. But not, you were singing, I assume.
I was singing. And after the second record came out, I was on the freeway in San Francisco and I heard the one DJ that happened to play the one song the one time I happened to hear it, myself singing, I pulled over to the side of the road and started crying.
Because of happiness?
No.
No.
I'm not good enough.
Oh. Okay.
So what I hear is singing.
Yeah.
No, I can't. I'm not that
guy. So David as producer knew that David as singer wasn't cutting the grade.
And I decided I'm going to be a producer.
Right.
And I quit and got a job answering phone in the studio so I could learn how to engineer, because in my recording sessions, the engineers were always stopping ideas. You can't do that. On my second album, I was working at the studio where Weather Report had recorded. So in my recording sessions, the engineers would often say, you can't do that. And I was trying to figure out why. There's a microphone and we're in a, can't we try it? And he wouldn't let me drag the Rhodes piano into the echo chamber because I wanted to hear the sound of the hammers in the reverb room for one section of the song, and he wouldn't let me pull it in. And another producer experience I had on my first album, we had a producer, and I'd written a line that was played by a clarinet and a flute and a synth, and different notes of the line would be played by different instruments, and when it was done, it would create a full melody. And I played the synth line And I went in the room and listened back to it, and he goes, "That sounds great." I said, "Yeah, when I get the other notes." "Well, no, this sounds great." It was like, do, dee.
Was he the producer?
Yes. One of my albums.
When you were the artist. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And the melody, I like it like it is.
Wow.
So it was these random notes. And this was not an abstract downtown New York producer. This was a guy that had done Jose Feliciano. He was not producing John Cage back in the day.
Right.
So every time I would hear those bleep book notes, then the melody was gone. So I decided I'm going to produce and I'm going to learn to engineer so I can engineer all my own stuff.
Right.
And
you as a producer, that's the through line, right? You've produced a lot of records, Dave, right, over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've been in the studio with a variety of artists. I know this is kind of a cheating question, but could you pick out your top three artists that you work with?
Oh,
Okay. We'd get you in trouble with the other 35.
Yeah. They're unique.
Yeah.
They're unique experiences.
Each one.
When they're really good.
I love all my children equally.
When they're really good artists.
Right.
Like Ingrid Michaelson, her voice is like silkworms weaving.
Okay.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And when Paul sings in his upper register and he goes across his break and you hear that open tone in his falsetto, it's just, I'm hearing this.
Yeah.
I'm experiencing it because when you're recording it, it's a much deeper experience.
Well, and you're helping them shape the musical context of it.
Yes.
Right? Which is a big responsibility for some of these artists, right?
It was pretty terrifying sometimes. Or with a new artist. I'm working with a new artist who, her name's Aya, and we did a version of My Life by Billy Joel. I didn't send you that, right?
No, I haven't heard that yet.
And I did it all orchestral and slow in a low key and a woman singing it.
Mm-hmm.
And she came in and I asked her if she would try it. I hadn't thought of her singing it. And she went out and sang it and she sang the first line and I got choked up.
Mm.
It was beautiful.
Mm.
And I played it for people who started crying.
Mm.
And she came in after she was done. I was coaching her through it, shorter words, longer, get louder here. And she came in and she said, "I've never been so scared."
Hmm.
And I had no idea that she was that way. That's an example of like when we finished it and she came in and she was shaking and the gender change in the tempo, the lowering of the register brought a whole new meaning to it. And then immediately I wanted to show it to everybody.
Right. Well, that I just, so it's clear to the people who are listening, what just happened is you played a track for me here, which, because it's a Billy Joel song, we can't really put it on the podcast per se because of the publishing and so forth. But it's My Life, right? That famous Billy Joel song, an orchestration by you, all with sampled instruments, right?
Yes.
And your artist, whose name is?
Aya Nori.
Singing it. And it was, I just have to testify, because out there, it's going to be a while before you're all going to get to hear it out there. But it's stunning. It's really stunningly beautiful. And kind of perfect in a way. So in terms of everything you just said about the resonance and creating the field with the creativity, and now we're at the point of like, how do we get people to hear that? I'm totally with you on that. For that to be successful, I don't think it's okay I'm the only one who heard it. I want to, and in fact, I'm the best person. If you ever want to get other people to hear something, I'm a blabbermouth and you should tell me. Don't tell me stuff if you don't want other people to hear it. But if you want other people to hear it, I'm good for that. And that was stunning. And you're right. There's something you want to just say, I'll go out on the street right now and I'll play it for people.
Yeah. I wanted to take it. I sent it to my sync guy, the guy who works sync. And I said, can you place this? Even though it's through Universal Publishing, he goes, well, they're great with sync. And I said, but can you? He says, I love this. I'll try.
What happens to that song if you don't succeed in that channel? Is there another life for this expression? Like, could you put it up on do a video of her singing it or something? Or
yeah, we could do that because as long as we're not, because you can cover any song, we just couldn't use it for sync.
Right.
So I could put it up on YouTube,
and they would just have to pay the royalties to the writer. Yeah, I think as a songwriter, if somebody took a song of mine and did that to it, I'd be like, you know, extremely, extremely pleased. I can only imagine. It was really exceptional. And now I want the people who are listening to this to be able to hear this. So we'll just have to figure that out another time.
And it's a good example when she hit the first line and she didn't know what she was going to do. And I realized it was in the proper key.
Right.
For her, the way her breaks work. And right. She hit that first line and I sat up and, oh, this is beyond what I imagined it could be.
And then did she sing the song all the way through? How did that go?
Yes. And then we went back through it 7 or 8 times to change phrasing.
Okay. And you coached her on the phrasing?
Yes.
As you do?
And then, but when I hear something like that, my immediate thought is, how can I gotta not screw this up?
Uh-huh.
Well,
you had already done the orchestration, right?
It was
finished. So you knew you hadn't screwed that up, right?
Well, it screwed up if the person singing it doesn't sound right inside that orchestration.
Sure.
This was a perfect for her voice and the way that I'd done the orchestration.
I mean, her timing was amazing on that. There were like little pizzicato cello things that were going on, and she was just right on the.
And I put the pizzicatos in afterwards based on her phrasing,
okay.
That one little phrase.
That one thing, yeah.
I did a stop. Yeah. And followed her line, knowing when I heard her sing it, I went, oh, I need a break there, and I'm going to do it with pizzicato.
So it's funny because we're talking about what to me totally qualifies as what I would call a spiritual experience because it was 100% fully invested in the activity that you're involved with, you with your full heart and mind.
Yes.
So that's what I mean by spiritual. You can get there how you get there, and you know you can – meditate or whatever you do or chant to tune your instrument up, but it's more about just hitting that spot where you're absolutely on the dot with what you're doing and with your full heart and mind. So then you go, well, okay, so this has two qualities. It has a creative quality that I'm going to say it's brilliant. I mean, I've heard a lot of what you do. That's really way up in the top echelons as far as I'm concerned. It's just beautiful and brilliant, Dave. And then second is you had a kind of resonant spiritual experience, and now it's making a buck because the sharing part to me inevitably connects. So I don't mean money when I say making a buck. I mean connecting with the flow of the world.
Well, what did I do when I finished it? The moment Aya left, exhausted and confused because she'd never had an experience like that.
Yeah.
And I sent it to my wife.
Yeah.
Immediately, and right. She wrote me back in 3 minutes and said, "This is beautiful." I started crying.
Yeah, because you had.
She got it.
She got it.
So I marketed it to Ava.
Yeah, to your wife. Yeah, wow. But you know, can't help it. And we're entering an age in which it would be easy to put that up, and if the word got out on it, to have 100 million people hear that.
Yes.
Whether you could work out the financial remuneration or not, that possibility is there, right?
Yeah, or 37 people.
Yeah.
That would be a good start. So if I post something on Instagram and I have a few followers, and then it's funny, immediately there'll be a couple people respond. I go, wow, what? Sitting on Instagram.
Well, and this whole idea of, you know, the podcast world, I mean, we're in sort of the shallow end of the pool on this, but people are getting turned on to by the millions to things just because one person likes it.
Yes.
You now have the power to kind of pass that through.
It's a lot of traffic. I call it the bigger haystack with the same number of needles in it.
Indeed.
But when you that I think that moment of sharing is a key. It feels like a lever, like a flip.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's our central theme tonight.
Yes.
Sharing. And you know, you are somebody who's had your work shared with millions and millions of people.
Yeah, so I got arrested for carrying a knife.
You did?
Yeah, an unconcealed knife. Turns out it's a against the law in New York City. And the top, it was in, you know, it's a regular knife. It wasn't open, but it was just showing slightly outside of my pocket. Mm. And two policemen standing on the street said, "What's that in your pocket?" And I said, "That's a knife." I didn't know. Right. But I had a knife because I'd been accosted outside of my studio because I always leave late. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, I'm completely unprotected. And these two huge people are trying to get money from me. And I was, so my gang friend sent me, FedEx sent me a knife. And I had to use it. But anyway, it made me feel something. So I said, oh, they said it's against the law. So I said, okay. So they had me walk to the police station, but they arrested me. And I called a friend of mine and said, I've been arrested for carrying a weapon. And what should I do? He said, well, you need a criminal lawyer. Call this person. So I called him. He goes, yeah, listen, I don't think you're going to go to jail. The court you're at, I clerked for the judge. Let's meet on Thursday at 4. And we talk about it. And I said, okay. So, and I get ready to hang up. And he said, just one more thing. I said, what? He goes, dude, fishbone. Mm-hmm. I have a punk rock lawyer. What? But so, and he knew that I'd drawn the fish.
Yeah.
So I'd made a connection to him 18 years before when he was in junior high school. Mm-hmm. And that felt strange at first, but then I thought, this is, I gave him something. Right. So that was my band in high school. So I'd shared something that he loved. And
he gave you a break because of that? Or?
Oh, no.
No.
But he got me off.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so sharing.
Yeah. That's an example, especially when music goes out. And music is particularly different than most things. I was talking to about a show that I'm working on, a TV show that I wrote, and the idea was about a way of finding music, and somebody said, oh, it's like Anthony Bourdain. And this other guy said, yeah, except Anthony Bourdain, you couldn't taste the food, but when you're doing music, you can actually hear it. I thought, yes.
Yeah.
The other thing about music is interesting to me is it's the only product I know of where the ad is the product.
Uh-huh.
So it's a jingle for itself.
Yeah. Jingle for itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes it.
Yeah, how would you advertise a song? You play the song.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
So that working in sound and the fact that resonance is actually the physical quality of it has always been so fascinating to me. And when you strike a chord, another nice phrase, with someone, you do feel the connection. And when you're doing it live, you can tell. I mean, you know from playing when everybody's into it. In the show that I'm writing about sound, it's a
TV series, right?
Yeah. That's the line is because I realized when I was mixing one day that we're all hearing one uninterrupted waveform our entire lives.
Each of us or as a whole?
Each of us. Uh-huh. We're here in this room and you're hearing me and I'm hearing you. I hear a little sound in my head. I just heard the elevator go up. That's all part of the mix.
Yeah, I've been hearing your chair squeaking.
Yes. Uh-huh. It's the experience that I had when I was mixing first and somebody had left the oscilloscope on and I saw the waveform and I realized it was a fingerprint of my mix and right. I soloed the bass and it was still this really complicated waveform. And then I saw the voices. It was still complicated. And then I put everything back in. I couldn't tell the difference by looking at it. And I realized I had this lightning bolt of, oh, shit, it's one sound.
The totality of it, you mean?
And that's all you ever hear your entire life. So the concept of it is one long song.
Yeah, well, like similarly, how many breaths do you think you take in a lifetime?
Yeah.
One. And the first one's exhale.
Uh-huh.
And the last one's exhale.
Yes.
No, the first one's inhale.
The first one's inhale.
Right?
Yeah.
And then,
Yeah.
Well, so now this is, you know, sort of making me think of meditation practice or the experience of meditating, which is when you talked about the sound, for example, you could do a meditation just listening to the sound without trying to do any management or manipulation or a sort of narrative element at all. That's actually a very pure awareness type of practice. You just
could. That'd be hard to do.
For me.
Yeah, it might be interesting to do for that reason.
Because oh, yeah.
You're not adding anything to it that's kind of creative or, you know, constructed. You're dealing with the unconstructed dimension of both the sound and your own mind.
Yes.
The unconditional part of it. So there's just to sit and bathe in a way in the arena of suchness, of experience that's just unfolding without your participation, without your attempt to try to turn it into something or turn it away from something.
Or when the siren goes by and you go, oh, that's a tritone.
Or that's a dead person going to the hospital.
With a tritone playing, which is the most disintegrable.
Yeah.
Couldn't they use a major third? It would be so much more uplifting.
Well, the premise is that there's a pure realm of sense perceptions. And Trungpa Rinpoche used to say this. He said, there are sights you've never seen. There are sounds you've never heard. There's dimensions to it. There's like a richness and a multifaceted aspect to just the sense perception, sound, smell, taste, touch. So that's why on the shrine sometimes they have like a mirror and a bowl of water, saffron water, and maybe some candy. It's just that you're actually worshiping the five sense perceptions. That's what's on the shrine.
So could I ask you a question?
Sure.
You left one out. So sound, smell, taste, touch, sight.
Sight.
But I've always been reading that consciousness was a sixth.
Yeah, now we're getting into a ripping good. Yeah. So actually there's eight consciousnesses if you want to get into it from the classical point of view. And it may take us too far off, of course. But
well, I just wondered if you're also – those are pure realm also?
Well, that's a really great question from a practice point of view, because the sixth one is the integration of the first five. It's like the central switchboard. So there is some element of coordinating them into some kind of sense. That's where you can sort of find shards of ego there, because somebody's trying to pull something together so that it makes sense that the fire engine just went by and at the same time your chair is clicking. Well, there must be a me here that's actually experiencing that.
Yes. Right?
Which is quite a leap, an assumption. And if you get into it, they say, well, that doesn't really mean there's a me there.
Yes.
It's just a sequence of experiences. And the assumption of a central reference point assembling it is an assumption. So, and usually that's not really a big problem, but it gets thick in there. And central headquarters gets very dense and it develops all kinds of stories and paranoid trips and kind of like excuses and, you know, stories of all kinds. So when you start to practice, you want to parse that out a little bit, thin that out a little bit.
Well, we always want a narrative to explain.
Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily – that usually can become a refuge for – negative emotions and things like that.
Or just pure ignorance.
Yeah, just dullness.
The sun is a chariot with a guy in it. Okay, great. Let's go to lunch.
Yeah, so in you're so close to a realm of pure sense perceptions, really more than most musicians I know, Dave, you know, because you're playing with just very, very pure relationship to sound as part of your art form. And you know, when I heard that arrangement, with the string arrangement is like ethereal. It's like you feel like you're in ether. And it has a beautiful, it's like sort of lands on the earth gracefully and on the water gracefully and a little bit of fire. But it has a quality of space that's very, very, when you listen to that, you feel like you don't really need to worry about your embodied situation.
My life.
Or my life either.
Well, There's an interesting point in there that you made me think of is also the fact that, okay, I'm sitting there listening to Bartok and Prokofiev. The opening to Romeo and Juliet was, I felt like I'd absorbed 100 years of music knowledge on that because of the counterpoint. And I went, oh, okay, I apply that to everything I do for the rest of my life. So that was a recording of the London Symphony Orchestra. Now, through sampling technology, over time, owning every sample library that was put out, and now realizing which I'm going to use the pizzicatos from there, and I'm going to use the sustained cellos from the Vienna because they have a slight lift to them after the attack for this one part, that I'm able, through the technology and the people that practiced, that can sit in the studio and make the recordings for the samples, that I'm able to put that together sitting on my own and create something that I'm resonating with and trying different things until I get it to the point that sound like I want it to sound like.
Right.
Then that's an individual experience that wasn't possible 20 years ago.
Well, so Dave, you know that I was involved with the development of that technology in its inception stage with New England Digital and the Synclavier.
Yes.
And so the people who are actually creating the cutting edge wave of what all this has become, of course, they're long gone in that respect, but they were there at the inception stage. And the chief, head of the company and the chief hardware engineer, I met at the Buddhist Meditation Center in Vermont. That's how I knew him. So it was that kind of synchronicity. He was a Buddhist practitioner. Sid Alonso was his name. And he's a monk in France now.
Wow.
So he's – and I just only talk to him every once in a while. But he asked me in 1971 – well, a couple of things happened. One is we talked about – we projected the iteration of the digitization of this audio industry that we went from 80 to 2000 was going to be the digitization of the supply side, which is the CAD-CAM, the manufacturing of music. And then from 2000 to 2020 was going to be the digitization of the distribution side. Uh-huh. So we were saying that at the beginning of the thing. But Sid was really a stone genius. And also he was an old-time fiddle player. It was kind of interesting. He was kind of a gruff guy in a way, an earthy guy.
It's amazing how many coders and digital people are musicians.
Well, in this company, everybody was a musician.
Yes.
And it was like we were inventing a new musical instrument. It was like being around when the harpsichord was invented or something like that. Later on, when the company grew, and this is sort of the business side, it had to get to the point where they had to bring in straight business people for marketing and manufacturing and stuff like that. But before that, everybody was a musician.
Yes.
But Sid asked me, and this is the point I was trying to get to, in, I guess it's around, 1980, he said, David, if I could get the music portaled right into your brain, he's only half kidding. And now we're only one-third kidding.
Yeah.
He said, would it still be music? What would it be? If I could bypass these organs of perception and somehow create the experience at a kind of a level of consciousness, what would it be like? And I've been thinking about that ever since.
Well, there's a part in that in my show where I built a model for the ear using a bass drum, three pieces of wood, a tube filled with electrostatic fluid, and the little when the electrostatic fluid is vibrated, it will light up some Christmas lights to show how it goes through your eardrum, through your three bones, through, and then you'd hit a big box and you'd watch it and you could actually see the latency. The reason I bring that up is because that particular apparatus is an instrument in its sense. It's a receiver that if you're going to do it straight into the brain, you would have a choice of any kind of apparatus that you could build. So we do hear 40,000 cycles. We respond to it. We could have something that goes into the brain that's from 15,000 up to 40, and that would be a different experience.
Well, and when I think about this possibility? I mean, you would know probably better than I that how close we are to actually doing this, because I'm sure it's inevitable.
Yes.
It's happening. It's coming. When I think about it, I think, well, here's the closest analog I can think of. When you dream music, which I'm sure you must because – or do you?
Yes.
Yeah. So I've dreamed – you know, I'm working on this musical. I dreamed an entire song from the musical.
Wow.
And literally, it was complete. It was complete. And I woke up and simply, as far as I know, wrote it, you know, just transcribed it, wrote it down, and then recorded it. But I – did I compose that? I mean, what – who – and how could I hear it? I wasn't – there was no audio. So audio in a dream would be pretty close to what we're talking about.
Yeah. And why right? It's the same as –
just pure consciousness.
Yeah. And by the way, I would suggest that you say definitely you wrote it so that you could put yourself down for the publishing.
And making a buck, folks. Yes.
I have more of an experience of when I'm working on something, I feel like something woke up.
Yeah.
Or that there's be a chord relationship. Or I'll hear, like when Aya started singing that track, that I had gone into a place that was not, I like to be, but I'm not there all the time.
Yeah.
Because there was a resonance going on. So it feels a little dreamlike in a waking life.
Yeah. So, you know, what's, again, we sort of tapped into the consciousnesses, but the capacity to connect with dream experience is important at a certain point in practice because there's a practice called lucid dreaming.
Yes.
You know, dream yoga, it's called. And if anybody's interested, you can read. There's a very good book on it by Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, the Tibetan practice of dream and sleep or something quite like that. And actually, they go into the dream. They train for this. It's just like learning a skill.
Uh-huh.
So
I've read about that. Yeah.
And they train to recognize, many people have had experiences with lucid dreaming, but they can't dial it in. You know, it will. But if they have mastered this practice, they can. And, you know, in the dream, one becomes aware that one is dreaming, which everybody's had some taste of that experience.
Yes.
But you can abide there. It's hard to stabilize that. And when you usually flicker through it when you're having regular dreams and you're kind of lost and swirling around, you know, you don't know where you're going or how you got there or that kind of thing. But in this, now all of a sudden, you have this sort of same type of consciousness that you do when you're awake, which was, we can be somewhat intentional. You and I are going to go have dinner after this, right? You know, we're going to walk into the restaurant. We're going to sit down, and suddenly we're going to be eating
sushi,
you know, sushi or a hamburger or whatever.
I'm going for sushi.
How do we get here?
Yes.
You know, we're here, and then all of a sudden we're there. And of course, you could say we walk molecule by molecule over there. But our experience of consciousness is not really like that. It's jerky. It's discontinuous.
Well, they study – I was talking with Robert Thurman a long time ago.
Yeah.
And he was talking about
– Professor.
The social sciences because he said, you know, when you call the Buddhist Studies Department at Columbia, I answer. But he said social sciences, they get they get sabbaticals every 3 or 4 years and because they're so well-funded. And I said, by who? And he said, well, mostly the ad agencies. So I said, oh, right, they're studying things like priming and because they're going to prime you in the ad. And the funny line, the funny description I read first of priming is you're at work, you're arguing with your boss, your chair is making noise. It's Thursday. I got to get. So you're on your way home. Oh, I'm supposed to stop and get food at the grocery store. My wife's going to be upset because I promised because we have these people coming over. And oh, look at that guy. He's so weird. And then you pull into your driveway. Who drove home?
Who drove home is a good title for something, right?
Yes. And that clicked.
Who drove home?
Who drove home? This primed guy. I get that all the time on my motorcycle. I'll go 2 blocks and all of a sudden I'll think, what did I just do?
Yeah.
Without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And then I think that's happening when I'm playing sometimes.
Sure.
Igor Stravinsky he's such a cool writer, and he was talking about his inspiration, and he said, that some of his best ideas happened when his finger slipped off F sharp onto the F. And I thought, good enough for Igor, good enough for me.
Wow.
He also has a great quote, by the way, about business. He said, I was contacted. I think I have this almost perfectly memorized. It's, I was contacted by Walt Disney Studios in Hollywood, California for use of my music in an animated feature. I said, well, I have to think about it. They said, well, we can use it anyway, because at the time the copyrights were separated. U.S. and Bern copyrights, Europe, U.S., they were going to use it anyway. So he said, I was invited for the over for the present for the premiere, and I was going in, and someone said, "Would you like a score?" And I said, "No, I know the music," and I was don't have anything to say about the visual counterpart component of it.
That's funny,
but I will say that the musical interpretation, all of the most difficult passages were omitted. And I would say that the interpretation involved a serious misunderstanding. As for the business, I was forced to accept, it was some amount of $3,000 or something for my work, which was reduced to $1,500 after the percentages taken by numerous crapulous intermediaries.
Crapulous? What, you memorized, you didn't hear him. There's no recording.
No, it's in his book, but it was like.
But you've glued it into your brain.
Numerous crapulous intermediaries. So I'm thinking, Stravinsky, he wrote this mind-blowing piece of music, Rite of Spring, and people were tearing the chairs up in the theater, and then over time, and then Disney's putting it into a thing, and then he gets nothing for it because of the copyright rules, and then he hated the interpretation of it. there was a lot of circles going on in that one. It pretty well describes
the music business.
Yes, or any creative business where you're bringing your little thing forward. And
well, I use Charles Ives as an example, because we talk about finding your offering, but then, as I said earlier, determining, is that your livelihood, or is that you don't want to subject it to that. And Charles Ives was an example of, he sold insurance.
Yeah.
He was a successful insurance salesman, apparently. He was a good businessman, but he didn't want that pressure on his music. He didn't want to be in that situation.
E. Cummings, too.
Really?
Yeah. He was, I think, an insurance executive.
Yeah. Great poet.
Oh, but used to Buffalo Bills defunct. Used to ride a water smooth silver stallion. Yeah.
So this notion of creativity, of course, you can't beat a horse too much. You talk about creativity too much, it sort of dries your mouth out in the wrong way. But when you tie it in with the notion of consciousness, and does it exist? Well, here's how we would talk about it in the Buddhist world. We'd say there's the Dharmakaya, which is the sort of pure realm of unconditional reality. And without – it hasn't taken any shape or form at all yet. And before it comes all the way down to this kind of manifest level of sounds and instruments and, people running around and recording studios and stuff, it goes through a realm called the Sambhogakaya, which is the body of bliss, the bliss level, the energy, the pure energy of it, which music is really Sambhogakaya level. It's all about sharing and communication. It has a tremendous sense of communication. Then it manifests as a physical person playing a violin. That would be kind of three kayas, or three bodies of experience, the three bodies. And they're inseparable. That's an interesting sort of notion. At first you'd say, well, my job as a spiritual practitioner is to get past the body, right? Get past all the sort of sense of experience, of any kind of experience, whether it's blissful or not, and get into this kind of void realm. And that's actually been the way some people have gone about it. But that's not the point. The point is that in higher level, they're considered inseparable, those three kayas. Uh-huh. And there's another kaya called Svabhavaka kaya that is the integration or the inseparability of those three.
Huh.
So we are, you know, in formless realm. We're in bliss of communication and sort of energetic realm. And we're, you know, physical manifestation.
Eating sushi.
Eating sushi.
Well, you know, that makes me think of something I thought of that struck me like a lightning bolt. I wanted to recreate it in the sound show. I was in Tokyo at Budokan when Paul was performing there, and it was a recreation. It was that Beatles playing Budokan was a big deal. Mm. They'd never had music there before. Oh. And it was a martial arts center. And someone told me there that the guy who ran it said if they let him play, that he would commit harikiri, or pronounce it wrong. Wow. And they played, and the guy didn't do it. So that was pretty shameful. But
maybe he liked the music.
Yeah. No, these guys are good, man.
Yeah, yeah. Do they have any records? Yeah.
So I'm watching the show. I'm at the sound booth. I'm working.
Yeah.
And
were you mixing the show?
No, I was recording.
Recording, okay.
To mix the house mixer, and I was supervising the recording for later for the record, for the TV show. So I'm seeing this huge thing of people flown in all over the world. There's a 100-person crew, this massive thing, 5-year-old kids singing every song, people cheering, beautiful presentation. The years, decades of energy to come to that point. And I'm watching this world encompassing energy all wrapped up together.
And then it dissolves into emptiness.
Yes. 1 second after the sound wave.
Yeah.
Second after second after second. One long song.
Dave, I think that's a good place to end.
Okay.
That's, it's been such a treasure to talk to you this way. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
You too. This was cool. I didn't know it was going to be cool like this. Thank you.
Okay. All right, everybody.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.